Here we go. January 25th, 2009, lecture number 77 on Genesis 1 through 19. And I have been still mulling over Bill Fast's great philosophical proposition from last Sunday, his offertory piece. And I assume that it will take its rightful place among the other great conundrums of history. And for those who weren't here, Bill posited, "Was I weird before I came to Cliffside, or has Cliffside made me weird?" And I know you're all thinking similar to me. You're thinking, can this riddle be answered? It's so impressive. And I say no. We're going to have to wait the perspective that comes from translation slash rapture slash resurrection. This is a messianic kingdom question. We have to have the history and the ability to look backward and see the entire scope before we can pontificate on it. Certainly, for now, we're going to have to dismiss and avoid the opinions of people who know us, which, of course, is our own families. Anyway, I haven't gotten away from it, and it is going to ruminate for a while. Enough of that. Though I reserve the option to revisit the issue in the near future, because it really is theological, pre-weirdinal or post-weirdinal, see? There isn't an weirdinal. It's just pre- or post-weirdinal. Anyway. That's correct. It's exactly right. It all fits together. Where did we leave off? Well, we left off adding 2 Kings 5 to 2 Kings 6. 2 Kings 6 to 2 Kings 5. 2 Kings 6, if you were here last week, and if you're not, you might have heard me do this lecture many years ago, so it's hopefully somewhat familiar to you. 2 Kings 6 is the floating of the iron axe head in the Jordan River, and it is the accompaniment to 2 Kings 5. They are a bookend set, or they are a set of themselves. And so 2 Kings 5, as you know, is the submerging of the leprous Naaman into the Jordan River. So the floating of the axe head in the Jordan River and the submerging of Naaman, the leper, Syrian commander in the Jordan River, are two pieces. And they have to be looked at as two pieces, and they have to be put together. And now I have a long advocated, as you may be aware, that these events occurred at the very exact same spot. In other words, Naaman, the Syrian leper, went into the Jordan River at this spot, and the axe head floated to the surface at this very exact spot. And that leads to an obvious question if one cedes the supposition. That being, if I'm correct, and I mean, well, why do we ask that? But if I'm correct, then here is the Jordan River. I'll make it wider. And that's the spot that Naaman and the axe head were floated and submerged. And they are two pieces of this whole. The obvious question being, what's up with this spot? Why that spot? Why not different spots? Why would it be the same spot, if I'm correct? Which is the same question as what? That we've done recently. Why the Garden of Golgotha? Why that spot? Why does he have himself crucified over the skull of Goliath? Why? What's up with that spot? Or the Garden of Gethsemane? Why does he pick these spots? What happened here at this place in the Jordan River? Why does God come here? If I'm correct. Okay, what happened here ultimately, as most of you are aware, I further suggest that this is the place that the ark crossed the river. So I have three things that happened here, if I'm right. I'm already tired of saying that. But for just seat it for me for a while. If the ark crosses here, crosses the Jordan River, where it stands ahead of the people. So the people must stand back as the ark goes first into the Jordan River and stand, and it stays there. They stay and hold that position. And the people, in other words, can't cross until the ark is alone and separate from them in the Jordan River. The ark being who? Really quickly. Yeah, that's obviously Jesus Christ. He has the ark of the testimony, or the ark of the covenant, is a profound picture of him. So if the ark goes across there, and the axe head floats there, and Naaman the Syrian, the leper is healed there, why? What's going on in this spot? As most of you are aware, and I'll further suggest even more here, this, of course, is Joshua 3:14 through 4:3. That's the ark going across the Jordan River here. This is the place of the 12 memorial stones. So I got 12 stones coming here. The River Jordan is heaped up at its origin point, which is where? At the city of? Okay, it's heaped up there. They go across at this spot. The ark goes first. I'm going to tell you, Naaman and the axe head, of course, same spot. Christ baptized that spot. Now I'm pulling 12 memorial stones out of there. They go in and they pick up 12 stones. They select men to do that. They put these heavy stones on their shoulders and they carry them out. And it's called the sign, the great sign of the 12 stones. Just as much as you need to know the sign of Jonah, you need to know what is the sign of the 12 memorial stones from that spot. And again, obviously, this is the exact place of Christ's baptism. I say obvious because, well, it's obvious. At least it is to me. He's directing us here to this place of the Jordan River. Why? Once you figure out, by the way, what the memorial sign is, and you figure out why Christ is baptized, then you're able to start to deduce what happened here. You have choices to what happened here. It's a Genesis 1 through 19 issue, so it really is relevant to what we're doing. And perhaps I should trudge off into Joshua 3:4 and Matthew 3:16. What is Matthew 3:16? Christ's baptism. What is Joshua 3:4? The ark crossing the river. Okay, maybe we should compare those because, again, it is a Genesis 1 through 19 issue as to why this spot. What happened here? It's a pre-flood event. What pre-flood event is it? You can contemplate that. How many choices do you have, by the way? What do you think is the number one view? If you study it, you're going to find there's at least five choices. And three of them come right out in the beginning. Three of them are fought over the most. So think about that for fun. Anyway, here's something else for fun while you're at it. For the rest of the sermon, you can do this. Look at Joshua 3:16. And then compare it with Matthew 3:16. And then go to John 3:16. And then go to 1 Timothy 3:16. And then finish with Revelation 3:16. You see, everybody always grabs John 3:16 and holds it up, and I always complain, don't I? I'd rather see Revelation 3:16. Okay? But they're all together. It's a fascinating study, by the way. Joshua 3:16 tells you that the origin of the Jordan River is Adam. Matthew is the baptism of Christ. John 3:16 is God sends, or Christ comes, He goes, right? Timothy 3:16, 1 Timothy, is the mystery of godliness. Revelation 3:16 is my personal favorite. It's the vomiting. It is the vomiting of the lukewarm. And I define the lukewarm as those who do not understand Joshua 3:16, Matthew 3:16, John 3:16, 1 Timothy 3:16. Extra credit assignment for those of you who have missed classes or who have poor test scores. You can go ahead and do that comparison in your spare time. You will like it. It is very, very much fun. Anyway, Joshua 3, Joshua 4 is filled with answers to New Testament questions. One of the places it is that it really helps you is the "it is finished" is. He says it is finished. There's four places he says it is finished. Two in Revelation, one on the cross, one, of course, in Genesis at creation. But Joshua 3 and 4 gives you an understanding of what is finished exactly. It's a very good place to answer New Testament questions. Plus, it requires that we compare Joshua 1, 16 through 18 to Exodus 9, 7, 19, 7 through 8. And what that is in both places, the people of Israel say, "We will do something." What will they do? Well, yeah, we're going to, in 19, 7 through 8 of Exodus, they say, "We will keep the Torah, we'll keep the Decalogue, we will do whatever you say." Yes, and how long did that last? Oh, yeah. Milliseconds. They're off building golden calves within minutes. Okay, hours. They say the same thing in Joshua 1, 16 through 18, just as they start to cross. They say the same thing. In fact, they say, "We have done everything that Moses ever told us to do." Now, this is the second generation, and we need to compare them with the first generation. It is this wonderful contrast and comparison between the first and second generations of Israel. The first generation dies in the wilderness, contrasted to those who cross the Jordan River and who are circumcised. The first generation of Israel that is circumcised, that holds these ordinances. They crossed the Jordan River on the 10th day of the first month of the religious Hebrew calendar versus the civil calendar. They crossed that spot on the 10th day of the first month. What else happened on the 10th day of the first month of the religious calendar as opposed to the civil calendar? Do you even know what a civil calendar and a religious calendar is? Every time you see a date in Scripture, you got to ask yourself, is this the Hebrew religious calendar or is this the Hebrew civil calendar? Because God changed the civil calendar into the religious calendar. And so some things He did on the civil calendar are actually things that happened on the religious calendar. You got all of that? You got to know your religious and your civil calendars. Because they change, sort of. Yeah, well, what happened? You're absolutely right. On the 10th day of the first month of the religious Hebrew calendar, not the civil, the religious, Christ entered Jerusalem on the 10th day. On the 10th day, the lamb is brought into the house and held for 4 days before it is slain at 3 o'clock. Christ, of course, as you know, gives himself at 3 o'clock. So that happens the same day that Christ enters Jerusalem is the same day the Hebrews of the second generation crossed the Jordan River, as opposed to those who crossed the Red Sea. When did they cross the Red Sea? They didn't cross on the 10th day of the first month of the Hebrew religious calendar. They crossed the Red Sea on the 18th day of the first month of the religious Hebrew calendar. Blah, 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 blah. But it's important. It really is. It's an Ishtar sermon. Good idea. This comparison of Joshua and Exodus and Matthew. Why do I say Matthew? Again, Matthew 3:16, Christ is being baptized in that river. And I propose that it is that spot. And I hope you realize how much time is required of you to fully or adequately, completely understand this Holy Bible you've been given. I say adequately because you'll never master it. Dave came up to me and said, "I'm just starting to study 2 Kings 5 and 6. Right, Dave? There's so many Daves, no one knows which Dave I am. You'll never know it was... I won't identify him. But anyway, he just came to me and said, "You know, I'm starting to realize just how amazing, how interconnected this is. This is an unbelievable book you have. You cannot master it." To just have a competent understanding of this Bible will take you a lifetime. A minute ago, what were we doing? We were talking about 2 Kings 5 and 6, and now bang, we're in Joshua 3 and 4, we're in Matthew 3, we're in Revelation 3, we're in John 3, we're in Exodus 19:8. We were crossing the Jordan, now we're crossing the Red Sea. We got 12 memorial stones, we got a sign of that, we got Christ's baptism. You have to understand Christ's baptism, and then you have to understand why that's a great sign. What's it the sign of, those 12 memorial stones that they took out of that spot? Why did God make His Bible so difficult? What is that? That is a really bad question. If you're asking that question, thump yourself. Because you are in trouble. He's done this on purpose, and He's omniscient. So that means what? This is the best possible, only one, alone way it could be done. If you're complaining about it, what have you just demonstrated? You're attacking His omniscience. You're attacking His plan. You're attacking His character. You're saying He doesn't know what He's doing because He made it too hard for you. Did He make it too hard for you? No, He didn't. Why did God make this so difficult? Yes, exactly right. Because it is for comfort, it is for wisdom, it is for courage, it is for witness. Those who search the Scripture will have peace, they will have wisdom, they will be salt, they will be light, they will have children that are salt and light. They face death without fear. That's why He made it the way He made it. And we're going to be held accountable. Sorry, not really. We're going to be held accountable for loving the simple. If you spend your life loving the simple and not digging into the Bible, you are going to get a beating. Sorry, not really. That's Proverbs 1:22. How long will you love the simple, you simple-minded? We're going to be held accountable for remaining on milk, Hebrews 5:12-14. We're going to be held accountable for knowing the mysteries of God, 1 Corinthians 4:1. Standing before Christ with the excuse that it was too hard for you is not a good plan. You heard it here first. Good luck with that plan. It isn't going to work. Just go get a hammer and beat yourself in the foot. I did that this week. Consistently. I rode a ladder to the ground. Which ladder? Yes, John's ladder. Pete has one of those ladders. It's still wrapped in cellophane, isn't it? And he won't use it. And so I've been reluctant. I've waited until today to say that I now have the exact scar on the left leg that I have on the right leg. The right leg was more impressive. The ladder is 36 feet. I was on a house that I built was 52 feet high, and I was at the peak with Lori's brother. And he was his knee-deep snow. I think it was April Fool's Day. If it wasn't, it's really close. And I am nailing it off with a nail gun, and the legs kick out, and I'm on a deck. So I'm 50 feet to the ground. And so I have a nail gun in my hand, and I am sliding down a 36-foot ladder. And I'm going, what are my options? Option one, get rid of the nail gun. Because if I hold on to it and shoot myself, that will just really make me mad. I'm not gonna... Option two is to enjoy the ride as long as possible until it crashes. And it put a hole in the right leg about the size of a dime, and it's still there. This one put a hole in the exact same spot on the left leg. But I only went down about 10 feet here. And it was Lori's fault. We'll talk about why that's the case later. Okay. Don't go in front of Christ. Just don't even open your mouth. But the last thing you ever want to say in front of God is, your Bible is too hard for me. I don't understand it. I didn't have time. I was too busy. Don't do that. I hope I've ruined your strategy. Every time I stand up here Those of you who was here for my Ezekiel study? Okay, four or five of you. Well, I think of Ezekiel 3:16. Ah, how about that? Through 19, really. I'm very much aware of Ezekiel 3:16 through 19. And as I said, I think about it every time I step up here. I always think about it. I don't miss a Sunday thinking about it, along with Ezekiel chapter 13. And frankly, I'm shocked at those who become pastors who do not care. They don't tremble at Ezekiel 13. I named my beloved border collie Ezekiel. And he was a great watchman, by the way. That's what Ezekiel 3 is about, is being a watchman. I have a job. My job is to ruin your life. It is. I read it. My job is to tell you that your ideas about, you're going to stand before Christ. And if you, like I said, if you think you're going to go up there with it's too hard, I didn't have time, you're going to get a, you're just going to get, oh my goodness. It isn't going to be pretty. You're going to be so ashamed with that excuse. And so what am I doing today? I'm ruining it for you. You know why? Because Ezekiel says, if I don't do it, who gets it? Me. And so I know that. I read it again yesterday, going, wow, that is as bad as I remember it is. And Ezekiel 13 is horrifying for a pastor to read. Horrifying. You say, thus says the Lord, and I have not spoken. God help you. You do that. I can go to 100 churches in this town today, 99 of them will say that. And it's horrifying. To read what he thinks of that. You have ensnared my people. God help you. Why aren't they afraid? It's the same question that God asked Miriam and Aaron. Why aren't you afraid of me? He used to have a partner, Dickie Schooler, a great friend of mine. He used to always say, where is the fear of God? You think it's going to be a picnic? You think there is no accountability for us? There's tremendous accountability. And I know it. And I will never stand up here and pretend that I have the Word of God through some miracle when it isn't true. Okay, I'm off topic. Where are we supposed to be? That's right. 2 Kings 5 and 2 Kings 6. The floating of the iron axe head. Once I get the floating of the iron axe head, that leads, when I add that to the leprous Naaman being immersed in the Jordan River, that gives clarity to the doctrine of Numbers 12 that was violated by Miriam, which then makes clear Leviticus 14, which then, yes, explains why the two birds were not divided in Genesis 15, and what the totality of the two undivided birds represent with respect to the person of and redemptive work of Christ. Okay? I hope we're making progress. As opposed to, I shouldn't say opposed, I should say in conjunction with Revelation 11 and Zechariah 4. For those of you who are affected by such things. Revelation 11, Zechariah 4 are the two witnesses. The two witnesses that ties into the two birds, right? That's why they always bring up Revelation 11, Zechariah 4. Whenever you're talking about the undivided two birds, you've got to talk about the two witnesses. And that gets you into Israel and the church, Moses and Elijah, the angels and the believers, and they're very much a part of the two undivided birds. But I'm neglecting that element. I'm not avoiding it. I'm neglecting it. There's a difference. Anyway, we are at 2 Kings. So, let's reread it. It's really short. There are people that weren't here last week. Have mercy on them. Reread the floating axe head. Open your textbooks up, and here we go again. And the sons, notice, by the way, that two guys came up here and put their ideas of what 2 Kings 6 is all about, and it's incredible stuff. That's what you should be doing during the sermon in your heads. That's what those tables are for. And the sons of the prophets said to Elisha, now this has everything to do with dipping a leprous Syrian commander in the river seven times. This is added information. This is more stuff that helps you understand what you just read in 2 Kings 5. And the sons of the prophets said to Elisha, see now, the place where we dwell with you is too small for us. We don't like it. It's too small. Please let us go to the Jordan River and let every man take a beam from there and let us make there a place where we may dwell. Okay? The place where we dwell is too small. Let us make there a place. So he answered, go. And I proposed last week, that is not good. None of that is good. Not liking the place you're at, wanting to go to another place, particularly when that place is the Jordan River, and the guy says, go. Not good. Then one, I sure like him. Remember I said we got to have a play where we got to do the play of 2 Kings 5, then we do the play 2 Kings 6. Don't be the guy that says, the place where we dwell is too small for us. Let us go to the Jordan. And there we're going to make a place. Go. Then this guy, my favorite, we'll call him Steve. Please consent to go with us. That's what he said. Yay for him. And he answered, Elisha answered, I will go. Those are tremendous words in the Bible, by the way. So he went with them. And when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. But as one was cutting down a tree, the iron axe head fell into the water. And he cried out and said, alas, master, for it was borrowed. So the man of God, notice that word. What's that word? I went over it really fast. There's a very important word there. If you want, put because. Or because of the word. So, why did the man of God say this? Why did he say? Where did it fall? What caused him to say it? If you will, cause. Omniscient God doesn't really work. Human perspective. So the man of God said, where did it fall? And he showed him the place. So, of course, he already knew. So he cut off a stick. Think of the anatomy of all of this. I get off the beaten track really far now. Guy loses his axe head. He's in big trouble. He is in big, big trouble. He's crying. He's in despair. It's borrowed. I'm doomed. I run and I go find somebody. Who do I find? I go find this guy. And I tell him, master, and I'm crying, it's borrowed. And because I say that, he says, show me where it fell. Now, does he know? Yeah, he knows. I mean, we got 12 memorial stones, I got the axe, I got Naaman, I got the ark going across, I got the baptism. He knows the spot, baby. That, of course, is my position. And he showed him the place. That's the third time. See now, the place where we dwell is too small. Let us make there a place. And he showed him the place. Three times I got a place. So he cut off a stick and threw it in there, in that spot. And he made the iron float. Therefore, he said, pick it up for yourself. So, he reached out, the one man who lost it, reached out his hand and took it. Okay, there we go again. This is kind of sort of where we ended. And we asked the obvious questions. And we really didn't answer any of the obvious questions, which is what I call a perfect sermon. You betcha. And I asked these questions. I brought them back today so I could repeat them without having to rewrite them. What place is this place Who is Elisha portraying, and how so exactly? Who are these prophets, these sons of the sons of the prophets? Who are they? What is the significance of Elisha saying, I will go? He will leave one place and he will go to the Jordan River. What's the significance of that? Go to another place. What is this borrowed iron axe head? Why the crying and the sorrow over losing it in the river? Go get another one, right? Obviously, you can't get another one. What, again, what place is this exact place? And the impossible happens by throwing in a stick. What's that? Where did it fall? That's a key word. Explain the pick it up for yourself and connect this to Naaman. There is the questions that we didn't really answer last week. So, and we're going to answer some this week. We're going to break with tradition and my general instincts and answer maybe three or four. And then what am I going to do with the rest of them? Leave them. Whose job is it? If don't, whatever you say, don't say what? I don't have time is too hard. Say, I'm not interested. I would rather you be hot or cold than what? Yeah. Because that's Revelation 3:16. That's the vomit place. Okay, there are the key elements, and there are key elements in all of these passages, in every passage they are, and finding the ones that are, I don't know how to say it, they're all very important. You can, the word so is very important here. Everything, no, nothing is insignificant or irrelevant. But some just really have a great deal more power, and finding all of them ones and putting them in the right order is very, very important. And understanding this is critical. And so first off, we take the context. Second, this axe head somehow relates to Naaman the leper. Somehow it does. How so? And that's vitally important. Now let me go over them again. The place is too small. Where they live. They don't want to live there. They want to go to the Jordan River. And then every man, let every man take a beam from there. And let us there make a place. We want to live there. We don't want to live here where you are. We want to live there. And he says, go. And one said, I ain't good. One said, you got to come with us. What's that remind you of right off the bat? Everybody takes off. He says, go. What do? Chinese fire drill, you know, horse, whatever, boom, off they go, right? One guy says, you got to come. You have to consent to come. What's that remind you of? Where is the New Testament compliment to this? That's right. Very well said. Luke 17. I got 10 lepers, all of them healed. One returns, he's a Samaritan. I will go, he said. Very, very important, I will go. One was cutting. What's the obvious question? Yeah, who is this one guy? Is he anywhere else in the story? The iron axe head falls into the Jordan, the crying, the alas, the borrowed. The question, where did it fall? You can't come up with a better theological word than fall. Where did it fall? And he showed him where it fell. And as many of you have figured out already, he already knew where it fell, but he wanted the one who lost the axe head to show him. And he cuts off a branch and he throws it in there. And the iron floats, and he says, pick it up for himself. So he reached out and took it. And there's your list. I should put it on the board, don't have time. But everything has a title to it now. The motive. What's the motive? We don't want to be in this place. See now, the place where we dwell with you is too small for us. With you, critical. Not good enough for us. That's the motive. And then there's the place. The place is the Jordan. And then there is permission. They ask permission. And then the consent, which is the I will go. Please consent. And then the fall, the despair, the borrowed, the return, the question, where did it fall? The showing, the cutting, the throwing of the branch, the raising, the command, and the obedience. All of those are there. Assign them to the list. And when you do that, now it's my hope that when you lay it all out like that, you begin to see what's being taught here. First and foremost, the Christology or the Christology. Find Jesus Christ. Where is he? Where is he? Uh-huh. Could be, could be. But first and foremost, let's go back. First and foremost, find Christ. The I will go is clearly something Christ says. He is with the Father, the triune God. One of the persons of the triune God consents to go and is obedient. You see, the same thing in Joseph. Go, the Father sends the beloved Son after the 12 brothers, or 11 in that case, who are far away in a distant land and lost and hate the Father and hate the Son. And the Son nonetheless obediently goes. Obedience of Christ is a very important doctrine to understand. I will go. Okay? So there he is. So he's being portrayed by Elisha there, isn't he? Where else is Christ? But he is, he's called the branch of David. A branch will be cut off, Daniel 9:26. You have Exodus where Moses cuts off a branch and throws it into poisoned water, and the water is now made sweet and whole again. So Christ is clearly the branch. He is called the branch. And it is said that he will be cut off. The Messiah will be cut off. It's one of the great prophecies of Daniel, the 70 weeks. He will be cut off after the 69th week. Jesus Christ will throw himself into the Jordan literally and symbolically, and he does when he is baptized. And I predict to you that he knows where that stick was thrown and that he knew where he wanted to be baptized, because he's what? Who is he? He's omniscient God. He's a pretty, he doesn't need a GPS to find himself around. He's got this worked out. Yes.
They just left Gilgal, where there was a famine. They were given sustenance, the sons of prophets.
Mm-hmm.
And now they come back again and say, this is too limited.
That's right. They're very, very similar to the nation of Israel as it's in the wilderness, by the way.
Is it possible the reason that they really left their place is because when Gehazi got struck with leprosy, that's where he lived, and all his descendants were there, his family were there.
I can't really derive that, but I don't want to ever say to you not think it through. Just because I don't have it doesn't mean that it is wrong, and just because I do have it doesn't mean it's right. All I'm really trying to do is get you to do what? Think it through. Figure it out. Some things I think are really clear. Other things like that, all I see in this is that they are with this powerful prophet of God who is a type of Jesus Christ, and they don't want to be there. They want to leave. And they want to go to the Jordan River, and the Jordan River is really obvious what it is in my view. Okay, Jesus Christ will throw himself into the Jordan, as I said, literally and symbolically, and therefore Elisha is portraying Christ when he answers, I will go. He also intercedes, doesn't he? He intercedes. You've got to ask yourself, why does he intercede? Elisha leaves one place and goes to another, and he goes to the Jordan River. So that's our second question. What is the first, we find Christ. What is the significance of the Jordan River? And it's previously discussed many times and stated, I believe that A.W. Pink has this absolutely correct. The Jordan River must be passed through for the second generation of Israel to get to the promised land, just as the Red Sea had to be passed through by the first generation of Israel. The Jordan River must be passed through, and it is a supernatural journey. He heaps up the water. We'll talk about that next week. At Adam, it is a huge mountain of water as they go through it. Same thing as the Red Sea. It's a supernatural journey. And I think Pink is right when he says this journey is the saved passing through death to life. Going through death into promise. And this is the promised land. The Jordan has its origin in Adam. So first I have it as death. Now it has its origin in Adam. It originates, its genesis, if you will, is in Adam. Joshua 3:16. Okay? Dan, Genesis 36, is a reference to judgment. I have been judged, therefore I will name my son through the handmaiden. That's what Rachel says. Judgment. Jor, Dan. Jor is to descending. So Dan, judgment, death, descending. You put the pieces together, the Jordan River is an emblem for death, sin, and judgment. I think if you study that, you will conclude that. And so, they want to go where? They want to leave Elisha, and they want to go to death, sin, and judgment. Hence the question. What are you thinking? Why would you do that? Now, next, this very precious iron axe head is borrowed, and it's lost where? In death, sin, and judgment. Naaman is dipped 7 times at the place where Elisha is shown. But Elisha says, where did it fall? That's the place Naaman is dipped. The fall happened here. That's what the guy tells him, right? Where was the fall? I'll get rid of the it. There's the fall. The fall happened right here. And Elisha throws the branch into death, sin, and judgment at the place of the fall. So far, so good, I hope. What is this iron axe head? It is borrowed. It must be returned. It is precious. It is lost in sin, death, and judgment. It must be found. It is raised out of sin, death, and judgment. And it is picked up. A branch must be cut off for it to be raised out of sin, death, and judgment. And I think the key is the word borrowed. And returned. That's what's key about Naaman. That's what's key here. It is loaned. It must be returned. There is accounting here. So, who's the owner of... First, what is the axe head? Yeah, it is our soul spirit. It is what he has given us. He gives us what? He is life. He has loaned it to us. The gentleman on the radio all the time says... Talent on loan from God. Well said. Life on loan from God. And note the man who lost it. He knew it was borrowed. That's pretty smart. A lot of people think it's my life. I hear that all the time. It is not your life. You borrowing it. Pretty soon what's going to happen? You're going to be held accountable for it. There's an accounting. Do people like that? People don't like that. See, now we're back to Ezekiel 3 again. People don't like it when I tell them, it ain't your life. You're going to be held in account for it. There is a judgment. It's my job to ruin your day. Otherwise, I get an incredible beating. I'm a coward. You get your own beating, I'll take my own. I'm not taking one for you. That's the disadvantage of standing here. You want to stand here? You get other people's beatings. Read your Ezekiel. But this man's incredible. He knew it was borrowed. A lot of people don't know they're borrowed. He cried when it fell. He had despair over it being lost. Most people I run into could care less. He knew it was lost. He sought out Elisha, just as Naaman did. Naaman follows a little girl. This guy knows Elisha is an answer here. He knew the only way I can get this borrowed thing back is what? A supernatural miracle. That's my only hope. And so I think this one guy, I think this is the guy. I think this is the guy that asked him to go. Yeah, he knew he had to go. You got to go. I'm in trouble. I'm going to you. This is a guy with the axe head. I don't know how many axe heads there are in this particular literally event that occurred. It wouldn't surprise me if every one of them had an axe head. Yes.
And where would the axe head have gone if it continued to float and was not picked up?
That's a wonderful question. Yeah. Yeah, he says, this is the most difficult thing to understand, in my opinion, in the entire Old Testament right there. Pick it up for yourself. So he reached out his hand and took it. Now, there are lots of people that don't want that verse in the Bible. Lots of people don't like that verse. That's a big deal, baby. Have you worked that out? I hope you have, because you'll be the only one. Keep starting. Naaman, also hopeless, I gotta hurry. He heeded the young Israelite captive girl. He raged, he was furious, but he heeded. And he obeyed, and he dipped himself 7 times. And then what did he do? He returned to Elisha. Because you know, Luke 17:11-18, oh, we gotta read that. We just gotta read that. It's too important. That's the compliment. Let's go. Luke 17. Hurry, I'll go fast, I promise. What's on the buffet today? I feel like I'm doing hee-haw. Didn't they used to do that? Some guy would come out and talk about the buffet. I'm hurrying. Now it happened as he went to Jerusalem that he passed through the midst of Samaria and Galilee. Then as he entered a certain village, there met him 10 men who were lepers who stood afar off. These people are away from God. They went to dwell someplace God wasn't at. They're away from Him. And they lifted up their voices and said, Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. Go back to 2 Kings. Alas, Master, have mercy on me. I lost the accent. So when He saw them, He said to them, go show yourselves to the priest. And so it was that as they went, they were cleansed. Now they obeyed Him. They did pretty much. That seems pretty easy, doesn't it? Hey, I want to be healed. Go show yourself to the priests. Did they think they were healed? They probably just walked off like this. He didn't heal us. He just told us to go show ourselves to the priest. He just told us to go dip ourselves in the river. He didn't heal me. He didn't wave his hand into a ceremony. He just said, go show yourself to the priest. Go dip yourself to the river. I promise you, every one of those guys thought, okay, this is a waste of our time. He didn't heal us. We're rejected. We're going to die. But they go. Let's go. Who knows? Let's dip ourselves. Who knows? Throw the branch in. See what happens. Have mercy on me. Remember me, God. Take a flyer. And so it was as they went, they were cleansed. And one of them, when he saw that he was healed, returned and with a loud voice glorified God, fell down on his face at his feet, giving him thanks. And he was a Samaritan. So Jesus answered and said, were there not 10 cleansed? Does he know how many were cleansed? Yeah. Does he know where the axe head went? But where are the 9? Where are you? God asks you, where are you? How's it going? Not good. Were there not any found who returned to give glory to God except this foreigner? Who am I? I'm God. And he said to him, arise, go your way, your faith has made you well. Okay, put all that together and then answer these questions. Why Did he give us life? Why did he give us an axe head in the first place? Why do we exist? Why do you exist? Why does anybody exist? Is he lonely? Why do you even got an axe head? Did you deserve your axe head? No, but you got one. And what did you do with it? You threw it in the river. We're all a bunch of what? Yeah. We can try to blame Adam and Eve, if you will. Many of them do. I wouldn't be like this. It wasn't for Adam. It wasn't for Eve. They did it to me. I'm just in the bus. You think you'd be different? You get your axe head and go, I don't want to live here. I'm going to death, sin, and judgment. Why did he give us life in the first place? Why does he create? That's a very important question. Very many, overwhelming majority of people do not believe that he creates. Why, after we throw our axe heads in the river, why, after we're covered with leprosy, does he consent to come after us? I will go. Hey, it's your fault. Why does he even come? You got what you deserved. Leave you alone. Why does he heal? Why does he save? Why does he cut himself off and throw himself in to sin, judgment, and death? Why does he raise anything out of that? Those are the great questions. 2 Kings 5 and 6. Let's rise and be dismissed.